Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. Today I'm speaking with Elsa Hart about City of Ink, the third of her mystery novels set in early Qing China. A friend of mine recommended Elsa Hart's Jade Dragon Mountain to me earlier this year, and as soon as I got into it, I knew I wanted to interview her. A combination of historical fiction, unusual solutions to intriguingly mysterious puzzles, and richly evocative portrayals of early 18th century China is irresistible. But you don't have to take my word for it. You can hear it for yourself. Summer, 1711. The courier rode out of camp in the yellow haze of a dust cloud. Wearing an expression of faint puzzlement, the man to whom he had delivered a letter watched him disappear amid the plumes of golden sand, before turning and re-entering a spacious tent. Its interior was filled with a bright clutter of painted furniture, rugs, saddles, and sacks. These were all coated in a layer of cooking oil and dust, suggesting that the portable dwelling, fashioned from wool felt on a wooden frame, had not been disassembled in some time. At its center, around a blackened stove with a chimney, four men were engaged in a friendly disagreement over ingredients for a stew. Waving away their curious glances, the man crossed to his pallet, sat down, and opened the letter. As he unfolded the paper, a small square of indigo leather fell from within. He picked it up and examined the rune stamped on its surface. It was a symbol he had not seen in all his travels. He turned his attention to the letter, which, to his relief, was easier to decipher. It was written in Chinese and addressed to him. There is, in the capital city of China, a small bookstore accessible through a door covered in a white curtain. At this bookstore, customers can purchase the City Gazette, a publication that provides news not only of happenings within the city walls, but of various campaigns ranged outside of them. It is my habit to purchase this Gazette, which is how I came to read, in a recent edition, an account of a banquet held for our Chinese ambassadors to the Mongols in Ordos. It contained a brief description of the storyteller who entertained them there, including, in an appeal to the whimsical appetites of capital readers, a selection of memorable details from the tales he told. Cursed clockwork, poisoned wine, a demon in the snow. Your subjects betray you, friend. Knowing your dedication to strange adventures, I write to ask for your help. If, when you have finished this letter, you are willing to undertake the task, here is what I propose. First, you must retrieve a book. As he read, the man began to smile, his eyes to kindle and glow. Winter had passed, and the dust storms of spring were giving way to summer. If he departed within the week, he would reach the imperial seat of the Chinese Empire before the leaves began to fall. And now, please join me in welcoming Elsa Hart.
Hi, Elsa. Thanks so much for agreeing to chat with me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have such a fascinating history. Tell us a bit about your past and how it led you toward novel writing.
Well, I grew up in a few different places. My father is a journalist, and he was the foreign correspondent for U.S. News and World Report magazine's Rome office when I was born. So I was born in Rome, and we lived in Moscow for 5 years after that. So my earliest memories involve a lot of Russian fairy tales, Russian art, picnics in the snow. And after that, we moved to Virginia for a bit and then to Prague, which is where I went to high school. So in writing historical fiction, I've really gravitated towards stories of travelers and of interactions between different cultures.
Your debut novel was Jade Dragon Mountain, which appeared in 2016, and is where we first meet Li Du and the man who will become his friend, Hamza. I'll ask you about them later, but could you give a brief introduction to that book, and especially the city of Dian, where it takes place?
Oh, Jade Dragon Mountain is a historical mystery, and it's set in China in the early 1700s. And it tells the story of Li Du, who is an exiled imperial librarian on his way out of China. And by the time the reader meets him, he's really embraced that solitude of exile, and he has very little interest in human interaction. But despite this, he meets and briefly befriends a Jesuit astronomer who is one of the many travelers who has come to see the emperor preside over an eclipse of the sun. And when that Jesuit is murdered, the search for his killer ends up bringing Li Du out of exile in more ways than one. And the book is set in a place called Dian, which is actually an older name for the city of Lijiang, which is a city in China. It's located in Yunnan province, which is in southwest China, and it's about as far from Beijing as you can get and still be in China. Yunnan sort of bridges the jungles of Burma and Vietnam and the icy plateaus and mountains of Tibet. And historically, Dian was a market town and a place on the trade route by which tea traveled from the forests of Yunnan, where it was grown, and to the arid Tibetan plateau, where it can't grow, and it was and still is very highly valued. So this old trade route was known as the Tea Horse Road, and the story is set on a big point in that trade route.
So Li Du and Hamza then move to the mountains, still on the Tea Horse Road, I think, in the White Mirror. Again, without giving away plot spoilers, could you give us a sense of the puzzle they encounter there?
Yes. So the White Mirror does continue along the Tea Horse Road. It continues Li Du's story on the paths of this trade route between China and Tibet. And it finds Li Du traveling with a caravan of tea traders. And he's deeper and higher in the mountains now. And the caravan becomes trapped by a snowstorm on a mountain pass. So the book is set up almost a little bit in the structure of a traditional manor house mystery, only the manor house belongs to a Tibetan lord. And just as the snow begins to fall, a body of a man is found on an icy bridge. So we have, you know, a suspicious family in the house and suspicious travelers trapped there. And in order to figure out who the murderer is, Li Du has to confront, surprisingly to himself, and I hope to the reader, some truths about his own past. And the story involves one of the great confrontations in history, which was that between the Emperor of China and the Dalai Lama at that time.
Which is still continuing in its modern form.
Yes, amazing contemporary relevance there.
So what inspired City of Ink?
The City of Ink, the first two books are set really on the borders of China, the very edges of its empire. And City of Ink brings Li Du to Beijing. And the inspiration for it really had a lot to do with Li Du's own story as a character. In the first two books, he's venturing farther and farther from the center of China. But by the end of The White Mirror, he learns something about his own exile that turns it into a mystery to be solved. So a return home for Li Du was always inevitable, but I was excited to bring him into an urban atmosphere and explore that different sort of mystery logistics and plot structures that offered.
So let's talk about Li Du. I mean, he's really a wonderful character. What's his backstory, as much as you want to tell us? And how would you describe him as a personality?
So Li Du, oh, dear Li Du, when we meet him, he is an exile. But before that, he was a librarian working in the Forbidden City in Beijing. And we learn that his family had hopes that he would rise a little higher within the ranks of the bureaucracy, possibly, you know, becoming a magistrate. But he became a librarian in part because of the influence of his mentor, who is a man named Xu. And we also learn that Xu was the reason for Li Du's departure from Beijing. Xu was found guilty of plotting against the emperor and he was executed for his crime, and Li Du, as his close friend, was sentenced to exile. So that's his backstory, and it took me a lot of time and a lot of different sources to find Li Du as a character, but he is inspired in part by an actual 17th century Chinese traveler whose name was Xu Shake, and his travel journal actually Li Du carries with him in the book. And I was reading, when I was in China, I was reading classical Chinese poetry in English, beginning with these beautiful translations of Tang Dynasty poems. And I was very moved by the language of exile in those poems. So that combined with these sort of journals of Xu Shake brought Li Du to a new kind of life for me.
He's very much a scholar, at least in my mind. How do you see him? I mean, he seems very contained, very intellectual. How would you describe
him? It's funny. So I would describe him as a librarian. There's so much in that word. You know, it was one of the very, very few moments in writing fiction when a character declared something about himself to me. I was writing a piece of dialogue very early in the process, and Li Du was talking to someone, and at that time I had no sense of him, his career background, and somebody, you know, asked him who he was, and he said, "I'm a librarian," and it was very much him introducing himself, you know, to me. And librarians in novels, you know, they really have this power of archetypes. I always think there should be a librarian card in a tarot deck, because, you know, my mind goes to the stories of Borges or Lucien the Librarian in Neil Gaiman's Sandman graphic novels, or the Ray Bradbury's The Father in Something Wicked This Way Comes, or, of course, Umberto Eco's Name of the Rose. So I think Li Du's coming from being someone who loves books is just so much who he is.
Librarian. I mean, what connotations does that have for you?
I think it's connected to his quietness and his tendency. One of the things that he struggles with as a character is that he can get a little lost in his own thoughts and in pages and books and documents. And that's really something that he struggles with in City of Ink, the third book, because he has come back to Beijing all sort of charged up to investigate his own past. But he finds that the answers lie in papers and documents sort of lost in the archives and the bureaucracy of the empire. And he kind of lets himself, he has a tendency to let himself get so drawn into that he forgets a little bit about people and about the importance of interacting and engaging. And that, of course, is what his good friend Hamza helps him with.
Yes, let's get to Hamza. He has a very different background, a very different personality. Where does he come from? What's he like? And why do he and Li Du click as friends, despite their differences?
So Hamza is a very real character for me. And my mom is actually always surprised about Hamza because she had no idea where he came from in my personality. But Li Du, she kind of can see. He's sort of, basically, Li Du, you know, went to law school and decided to be a librarian instead, and then kind of wandered politely around the Chinese countryside, which is essentially what I did. But Hamza's different, and, you know, he appears as a balance to Li Du, not quite a sidekick, more of a friend and someone who approaches problems from a different perspective. And he is by profession a storyteller, and that was important because I think if my books have one common theme between them, it really is storytelling, and in particular, the use of narrative to build empires, or to, on a more personal level, to avoid facing problems, or to get away with murder, or to justify murder. So I guess it shouldn't have surprised me that a storyteller would show up in my head in plotting out and figuring out the themes of the books. And I do think Hamza acts a bit as a guide to the novels. He appears in the prologues. He exists a little bit outside of the stories. And I think he helps emphasize that we aren't in a completely straightforward historical moment, that the worlds of these three books are to some extent outside of time and consistent within themselves as stories. They're crafted, and Hamza helps keep a little bit of an awareness of that.
You also, I think, grounds Lidu in a way, which is fascinating because Hamza's own stories are very much, you know, folk fairy tales that are not based in sort of the reality of everyday life.
Yes, I completely agree. He grounds Lidu, maintains that human insight and a sense of humor, which is something that Lidu sometimes Lidu can be a bit gloomy and serious. So I think Hamza jostles him out of that, you know, when he needs it.
The historical background of these stories is really fascinating to me, in part of because of my own research and writing interests, but also because it's so richly depicted. And I think probably a lot of our listeners don't know very much about this period in China. It's the beginning of the Qing Dynasty, the Kangxi Emperor, and there's a lot going on. I'm sure we could talk about it for hours, actually, but tell us at least about the emperor's somewhat complicated relationship with foreigners, which is an element in all three books so far. Who are these foreigners, and how do the imperial family and native Chinese react to them?
Yes, absolutely. And I agree we could go on for hours. It's just such a fascinating and complex period in history. But so in China, in 1708, when the book is set, as you say, it was not long after the start of the new dynasty, the Qing Dynasty. And of course, it would be very long, but it would prove to be China's last. So when it ends in 1911 with the Chinese Revolution, that's the end of thousands of years of imperial China. But, you know, in 1708, it's just getting started. And leading, I promise, to the foreigners, the brief background on that is that this dynasty was founded by horsemen from the north beyond China's border wall, who were called the Manchu. And they came to China, they took Beijing, overthrew the ruling family, and declared themselves the new rulers, and they called their dynasty Qing. And the emperor in 1708 was only the second Qing emperor to rule, and he was the Kangxi emperor. The Qing, even though they were an invading power, they had kept the traditions and much of the bureaucracy of their predecessors intact. So in many ways, Kangxi was really working hard to learn this ancient system that he had inherited and to legitimize himself in the eyes of the people his family had conquered. And that's where the foreigners come in, because one of the ways that he was doing that was by using technology that was brought by Jesuit missionaries. In the West at this time, there was growing interest and fascination with China and demand for its goods, most notably its tea and its porcelain. But the English East India Company and the other traders had nothing that China wanted in return. So at this point, China's borders really were essentially closed to Westerners. But the Jesuits were the exception, and they were allowed in. They had first come to the imperial court during the previous dynasty, about 100 years earlier. And the Kangxi emperor had sort of inherited them. And he found them extremely useful, in particular, their knowledge of astronomy helped him to make more accurate predictions of events like solar eclipses. And this contributed to this effort he was making to establish his authority. So he liked them, and I think even considered some of them personal friends, though of course there was an instability to that dynamic.
And not all of his subjects are equally enthralled, right?
Absolutely. There was a lot of resentment and competition among his Manchu advisors and shamans and also from the Chinese bureaucracy competing for influence over the emperor with the Jesuits and not liking this foreign presence.
Another element in the stories, and you hinted at this before, is that because it's a new dynasty, there are lots of supporters of the old dynasty still around, and they keep popping up in different contexts.
Yes.
So could you talk about that element of it a little bit? I'm not asking you to give spoilers from the stories, but just the general political background, shall we say.
Absolutely. The Qing dynasty trying to establish itself while keeping a lot of the structure of this previous dynasty intact. So with that dynamic comes a lot of tension. There were many outright plots to reinstate the Ming royal family. By the time my books take place, it was at the tail end of that. They were pretty much trounced, that there were little ones that came up every once in a while. But one lasting effect on the atmosphere that comes up, particularly in the city of Vinc, is the rearrangement of where people lived in Beijing. So the nobility of the previous dynasty had lived in these beautiful, fancy northern neighborhood mansions that surrounded the Forbidden City. And they had all been kicked out and moved down to the southern part of Beijing, while the emperor's Manchu bannermen had more than moved into their nice houses. And the south of Beijing was considered very inferior. It was foggy and muddy. It didn't have any good prospects or views or sights to see. So there was certainly resentment about that and a cultural clash that was going on within the city still at this time.
So that brings us to Beijing, which is almost a character in the novel itself. I mean, it's setting and it's set up, and all the streets and everything are essential elements in the story, including, and I didn't realize this until I read your book, that at night, for security reasons, a lot of the streets were closed off. So they didn't just have walls around the city. They actually had walls within the city. Were you aware of that before you started writing?
I wasn't. No, my initial research process with the books is very eclectic. So I will know basically, you know, where I want to set the book and what I want to have happen in the story. But then I'm really looking for inspiration, and I certainly found it in reading in preparation for writing City of Bing. There's a book in particular, Peking Temples and City Life by Susan Naquin, that I think is where I got this from. But yes, there was incredible amount of control of the movement of people within the city. So there was a wall all the way around Beijing, and then a wall separating the northern part from the southern part, but then within those, just an enormous network of walls and gates and doors that closed at night very strictly and were monitored by guards. So essentially, wherever you were when the sun set was kind of where you had to stay for the night, which was both fascinating historically, but a great plot dynamic for a mystery too.
So as noted in the book description, and as just mentioned by you, Li Du has come back to Beijing with a specific plan. But by the time we meet him at the beginning of City of Ink, it's 2 years on and things haven't worked out quite as he expected, in part because of all of these documents that you mentioned. But what is his situation at the beginning of the story?
Yes, so we find Li Du working in a somewhat humble administrative position in the South City. He's essentially working for a local constable. And he 2 years have passed since he came back. And he wears glasses now, which have been given to him by one of his Jesuit acquaintances. And so, yes, it was, I can't remember exactly when I made the decision to have that time pass, but I did want to give him that new sense of struggle that he came back all sort of full of fire to solve this mystery of his past, and then found himself, you know, getting a little bit lost in the paper trail, lost in the labyrinth. As I mentioned before, he has a tendency to gravitate towards quiet, very internal places, and he's a little bit directionless by the time we meet him.
And how does he get involved in this mystery? Sketch the setup for us.
So the crime in City of Ink is a double murder, and it's the bodies of a man and a woman have been found in the black tile factory. So this factory that produces the roof tiles, the sort of standard roof tiles that cover the houses in Beijing. And the man is a relatively high-ranking official. The woman is the wife of the factory owner. So the woman's husband is the prime suspect. It seems that it was a crime of passion. And because Li Du's boss is, this crime falls within his jurisdiction, and, you know, Li Du is brought along to investigate.
And if it is found to be a crime of passion, what is the significance of that legally?
So there was a statute, and this is true in place at the time, it was Article 285, that said that when a wife or a concubine commits adultery, and her husband or a close relative of her husband catches her at the place and in the act of adultery and immediately kills them both, there is the crime is excusable because as long as it was done, you know, in the heat of the moment. So for this story, for City of Ink, it means that if the husband did it, everything is pretty, the answer is pretty easy for everyone. His act is justified. He's let off the hook. It's not too messy. So, you know, a number of characters are trying to make that fit, even though it doesn't quite.
And one of the reasons that that's important is because this is taking place in the lead up to the imperial examinations. So talk about that part of the story.
Yes, I loved reading about these. I just, the details, the anecdotal details are just wonderful. But so the examinations for any man who aspired to become an official in the bureaucracy, passing the civil examinations was essential. And these took place, there were several rounds of them, it's a complicated process, but essentially every 3 years in the capital. And in the weeks leading up to these tests, Beijing just completely transformed. There were thousands of hopefuls pouring into the city. They came on horseback and they'd carry these fluttering banners that identified them as exam candidates. And the inns filled up completely. The temple guest rooms filled up. And in addition to servants and family members, the candidates brought all these anxieties and superstitions. And there were all these charlatans trying to sell, you know, potions to help you concentrate. But and part of the reason why it was so tense is you had, you know, thousands and thousands of candidates. And because of a quota system, a very limited number of them could pass. There was space, I think, for about 200, depended on the year, but about 200. So the atmosphere is incredibly tense and competitive and a good setting for emotions to run high.
So without specifying how they work their way into the plot, there are a couple of Jesuits that Li Du encounters in this novel as well, Father Calmette and Father Avenot. Who are they and how do they fit generally into the story?
So there are two of the Jesuits living in Beijing, and the essentially working as advisors to the emperor. But at this point, the influence of the Jesuits is waning. You know, they have their church. It's not very well frequented anymore. Their position is a bit unstable, and I'm not sure if I don't think I mentioned this earlier, but there's a lot of infighting in the Catholic Church over the role of the Jesuits in China. So they're in a stressful situation. And Calmette, though, the older of the two, he speaks very much to the intellectual curiosity of the Jesuits who are in China at the time. And it's an intellectual curiosity that really survives in the letters that they wrote and that still exist and you can see and is very relatable and contemporary. But Avenot, without spoiling anything, speaks perhaps to a darker side of that curiosity and to the tensions surrounding the place of the Jesuits in the capital and their future there.
Tiles, especially roof tiles,
yes,
play an important part in City of Ink. Some of them are made in Beijing, others are outside the city. There are factories that specialize in different types of tiles. Some of them are standard, some are produced to order. How got you interested in tiles to the point where you decided to include them in this novel?
It's a good question. So as I said, my writing process starts with this very eclectic research, and I came across a description of kilns that had been moved outside of the city because of pollution complaints. And that stood out to me because, you know, it felt like reading a contemporary article about Beijing and the sort of and pollution problems. So that got my attention on kilns. But then as I read, I really liked the idea of focusing on kilns in a different way than focusing on porcelain. So much of Western imagining of China is centered around its porcelain and the idea of thinking about these more industrial kilns that were producing the roof tiles that really defined the appearance of the city, this sea of roof tiles, both the plain unglazed black tiles and the glazed ones that were used more for ornaments and on temples. And then, of course, the beautiful ones that top the yellow ones topping the Forbidden City. So I think that's what drew me to the idea of this, yeah, this more industrial kiln structure of the city intrigued me.
So you mentioned that that your research is very eclectic, and I totally agree with you because I'm a historian who writes historical fiction. And the thing that I love about doing research for a novel is that it opens up all these possibilities that I either had forgotten or didn't know about. And that's much more important to me than the sort of nailing down exactly how people made their buttons or whatever it was.
Right.
So given that yours is eclectic, where do you start? Because these settings and backgrounds in the novel are so beautifully realized that I really want listeners to hear that this is an element of the novels that they should, you know, prepare to enjoy, really.
From a lot of different directions. And for Jade Dragon Mountain, unique among the three, because I a lot of the description came from what I was seeing around me. You know, wrote Jade Dragon Mountain when I was living in China. My husband is a biologist, and he was studying high alpine plants on the real Jade Dragon Snow Mountain. And we were living in Lijiang, the city at its base. So I was looking up at the mountain every day and seeing its changing moods and the shape of it that has changed very little over 400 years and the movement of the mists through its valleys. It was almost like time travel. But in addition, specific to Lijiang as a city, Lijiang was a pretty much very small contemporary Chinese city. But then in 1996, there was an earthquake that did terrible damage, almost leveled it. And the decision was made after that, instead of rebuilding it in a contemporary style, to rebuild it in a traditional old style. So it is now a UNESCO World Heritage Site and a major tourist destination, particularly for domestic tourism in China. So in Lijiang, there is a full replica of the Mu Mansion. And if I got up early enough, you know, before the tour buses came in sort of sneakers and with cameras, it really felt like I could just take notes as if I had gone back in the past on the architecture and the cobblestones and the way the sunlight hit the rooftops. So that was an eerie way to research the first book. But then, of course, there was a lot of academic research, and that took place mostly in university libraries when we were back in the U.S. for holidays, and also in museums. I did a huge amount of my research in museums. My parents were living in Washington, D.C., so the Freer and Sackler were a great place to go to, you know, find objects that I could place in the text.
And what would you like readers to take away from your three novels so far, but especially City of Ink?
I think much of my focus when I talk about the books is on the geographical and the historical context for the novels. And although I enjoy research so much, the books are more mysteries than they are histories, I think. And what I look for when I'm poring over these nonfiction accounts are the elements that really lie at the heart of mystery: glittering wealth and scorned love, and the emotions that they inspire, the fear and greed and desire for revenge, those motives. So the world my characters inhabit doesn't operate according to the same rules that, you know, govern our reality or the reality of history. But that said, I'm also conscious of, and I hope the books kind of call attention to, the reality of history being something we encounter through accounts given by those who chose to write things down. So the Jesuit crafting his letter to Rome, or the emperor dictating an edict, or the traveler taking notes about a route. They were all written for an audience. And this gets back to the theme that found its way into my books, that these plots really turn on understanding that there's a storyteller behind every story, whether it's an emperor controlling the narrative of his empire, or an author constructing a novel, or a murderer justifying a crime. So I do think it's one of the reasons that a librarian and a storyteller ended up as my protagonists. So it's really been a pleasure to travel with them and to share some of their story in our conversation today.
Are you working on another Li Du novel now?
I am deep into my fourth novel, which is a shift away from Li Du and from China, but it does take place in the same period, in the early 18th century. It's set in London, and it's specifically in the community of collectors who were building what are sometimes called, referred to as cabinets of curiosities. So I'm so drawn to the in-between times in history, and this is one of them. You know, England on the brink of the scientific revolution, but at this point, you know, Newton is still really interested in alchemy. And I'm introducing two new detectives, Cecily Kay, who's a plant enthusiast, and Meekin Barlow, who's a botanical illustrator. So they're navigating this world of obsessive collectors. And for fans of Jade Dragon Mountain, there is a cameo appearance from a character in Jade Dragon Mountain who they will recognize.
Okay. I have my theories about who that might be. I will look forward to seeing that novel, but I do hope we haven't seen the last of Li Du and Hamza.
I hope not too. I do have more stories in mind for them as well.
Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Elsa. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you so much for having me. Pleasure for me too.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction, a podcast channel in the New Books Network. And today I've been talking with Elsa Hart about City of Ink. Find out more about her at www.elsahart.com. Like us on Facebook, search for NB Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Histfic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, where I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye until my next conversation about historical fiction on the New Books Network.